Hi, welcome to How We Got Here, a genealogical podcast. My name is Brian Nash, and I'm the host. And on today's episode, first up, we're going to talk about census. May 11th, 2021 is the next census day, so I'm going to just be the first in a series on talking about the Canadian census. Today, I'm just going to give a general overview and what the census means to a genealogist. In my second segment today, I'm going to be sitting down and talking to Carl Sharman, a fellow genealogist and podcaster. We'll be talking about his podcast and his first diving into his ancestry from Acadia. And after that, we'll be ending the day just talking a little bit about collaborative genealogy and how you can help one another build your family trees.
Welcome to How We Got Here, a genealogy podcast hosted by Brian Nash, exploring the tools, tips, and resources for genealogists from Atlantic Canada and family historians from around the globe who are researching their ancestors from Atlantic Canada. Every family has a story, so stick around as Brian and his guests share the unique family stories that help shape the history and culture of Atlantic Canada.
So, we're, halfway into the first month of January now, and of 2021, it's a new year. Not a lot has changed in the world, but as a genealogist, we like to know where things are, and like to know that things are consistent. So, one of the things that we do in this country, and many countries around the world do, is consistently they do censuses. Canada does a census regularly every 10 years and also an agricultural census every 5 years in between as well. This year, May 11th, is Census Day. This is how it works is every year a census, there's a specific day where that information is gathered. So the information is based on a snapshot of that particular day. So we've been doing censuses in Canada since Confederation. Well, in our original Constitution, the Constitution Act of 1867, the B&A Act, it was mandated that a census get done, and the first one nationwide, or as the nation existed at that time, was in 1871. So, I'm not going to go into the details of the different censuses. I'm going to actually sort of spend a little bit of time over the next few episodes sort of breaking down each census year and sort of what will be there. I just wanted to talk a little bit in general about censuses and their value to genealogists and how they're a tool that we should be quick not to overlook. In fact, I often use it as one of my first tools to go to and start finding out information. Like I said, Canada isn't alone in the world doing censuses. They have been done across the world. So what I'm going to do is, like I said, over the next few episodes, I'm going to talk about the different Canadian censuses that are out. Every 92 years, they get released. Well, 92 years after they're done, they get released to the public. So the next expectation will be in May of 93, 2023, we should have the 1931 census released. So the most recent census available for Canadians is the 1921 census. So we'll be starting off in the next episode talking about that, and we're going to do what we do in genealogy. We're going to work our way back. So let's just talk about what kind of information and why the census are important for us to use as a tool, what kind of information we'll find. A lot of it depends on the year, and then, as I said, we'll get into the details of what each one contains. But generally, the information is, it's a record, it's a snapshot of a picture in time. So there's a lot of things we have to remember when we're looking at census, and the big thing is to remember that it is a picture of that day that the census was commissioned for. Canada has a great website for viewing census information, and I'll be referring to it throughout the next few weeks as we talk about it. The simplest way is if you actually just Google Canadian census, and you should get the link to it. It's a nice long government link, so I'm not going to repeat it, but I will include it in the show notes. And there you can find out all the census information. The other great source I found is, I mentioned this on one of my previous episodes, with the Ancestry, the library edition. They have some great records there. If you don't have an Ancestry subscription, you can use it as long as you have a library card. Most libraries in Canada, I believe, are subscribed to it. So check out your library and find out, and they can tell you how to access it. The great thing is they do have some really neat, good transcriptions, and I'm going to be putting out a YouTube video sometime over the next few weeks on a cheat I've made for viewing the census. If you're breaking down small areas to actually take that information and grab it into a spreadsheet to make it a little more easy to manage and review. So there's a few things before we talk about any of the censuses, like I said, that we sort of have to know. One of the things is you have to remember that they are not necessarily a first-hand source. Census people can't ask a neighbor if you're not available, and this has been the way it's been for a while. They can ask somebody in the family who doesn't have all the correct information, but they are still a really good source and a picture of what was going on in a family or a community on that particular day, and give a picture where they're at. I really like using them because they're great. If you can't find some of those primary records, it can help you guide where to look. A good example is when you're looking for, you have a grandparent or a great-grandparent that is in a particular census, you can find it. You should be able to find them if you have an idea of where they're at, an idea of what their age was in that year. If you're doing a search, because it does let you search on the Library Archives Canada, their site, remember that census is done in May, so you have to think of what the person's age is or year of birth is based on that day. I honestly usually start looking 2 years forward, 2 years back. I find most ages, are pretty known in that. But the other thing is, too, if you can't find the person that you're looking for, you might be able to find another relative that lived with them or lived in the same community, so you can sort of track your relative down through that. One thing that's very important is that a lot of the indexes, they're reading people's handwriting, and I know if anybody tried to read my handwriting, they'd have no idea what I was recording there. So with that, I've seen a lot of censuses where the transcription isn't the greatest. Good thing with surnames, You can usually figure it out. And it's like any documents when surnames were given, including immigration records. The person recording it is probably going to write it how they hear it phonetically if they're not familiar with that name. I have an example of looking in a community index. My great grandparents' family is in, and it's not a family member, but I noticed there was this name Persons that kept showing up, and I was just curious because it was a different name. I have heard of it before, but it was showing up for a couple families in this community and in the indexes. So from putting together some more information and matching names with other community records there, I realized that the name is Parsons. So if I was looking for that person, if I was a Parsons donor, I was just relying on the index and just searching for Parsons, I probably wouldn't find them. So yeah, be aware of that when you are checking for people. Make sure that you are checking for alternate spellings. Think of how somebody might write that name if they're hearing it phonetically, especially if it's a name that it wouldn't be unfamiliar, even if it is. My own last name, Nash, I've seen written multiple ways. I've had it written multiple ways by multiple people. So it's really, you have to think about how you want to look and sort of widen your range and thinking there. And as genealogists, we get used to that. We also, you can start to become over time familiar with the wrong spellings of your surnames and your family. I keep a little spreadsheet file of all the different ones that I have, and the difference is in them, just so I can search. There are some good programs that are really great. They'd actually do able to figure out the sounds likes, but even then, they're not always accurate. So what do we use census for? We use them I use them anyways, as a guidepost to get more information when I don't have it. A good example is when you're trying to find a birth record for a person. If you can find them in a census and you find them in that family, you can see where to look and where to begin to look for their birth records. If you're not sure where a person's lives, and a lot of the censuses do have their nationality, so that's how you can tell if a family member was from Italy, or a lot of times you could by name. Yes, I know, but if there was a person you just weren't sure, or you weren't sure if they were the first generation or how many generations, because some of the censuses do have that information, not only on the person there, but also on their parents' heritage. You can find out years of immigration. That's how I found out my great grandmother's that I talked about in my second trailer. That's how I knew she immigrated in 1905. In the 1921 census, her family was listed as immigrating to Canada in 1905. So I knew where to search for those ship records and passenger records. So it's really a great resource. Like I said, I'm going to go over them starting in the next episode. I'm going to start on the 1921 census, and I'm going to work my way back to the 1871. There's a few censuses before that, and I'm probably going to group those into one or two episodes. Hey, I want to welcome to my podcast today a fellow Canadian genealogist and a fellow podcaster, Cale Sharman. And I'm saying that right, Cale?
Yes, you are.
Okay, great. I just want to, I invited Cale today because he started doing podcasting on genealogy about the same time I did. And we actually recently connected, and I've become a fan of his podcast, and I really like the format and the that he's taken is a little different from mine, but it's really great family stories he's sharing. That a lot of them are personal to his family, but I really, from listening to them, you can relate to them as a Canadian, as somebody who's interested in Canadian history, or somebody who has ancestors that probably have a very similar background. So, Cale, just to get started, I usually start asking people about how they got involved in the genealogy, but I want to just give you a chance to talk about your podcast, and hopefully we can get some of my listeners over there, and so they can enjoy and get out of it what I've been able to get out of it.
Sure, thanks. I really appreciate that. It's called the Maple Family Treehouse, and it's available on seven platforms. It's distributed from anchor.fm, and that's a great place actually to start because you can leave messages and feedback for me, but you can also get it on platforms like Spotify or Google Podcasts.
Okay. And so what made you, well, let's actually start with the genealogy, and then we can get maybe into what made you want a podcast about it too. So
Okay.
how did you get develop your first interest in genealogy and family history?
Well, actually, I'm a high school history teacher. And so probably the seeds of it started when, some of my tougher students that were harder to kind of motivate and reel into the whole taking history in school thing. I would say to them, why don't you start with your family stories? Why don't you start with yourself, your parents, your immigration story, maybe? And, then you can link it to larger themes, which we're probably talking about in the class, And if history in a classroom can mean something personally to a student, and you would see light bulbs go off, and eventually I said to myself, maybe I should take my own advice. because you know what, honestly, when I was younger, I was not a history person. It's just, and I think a lot of people could probably resonate to this, that, as you get older and as you experience events in the world, as you start to see themes over your life and listen to stories from people in your family and be the torchbearer of those stories, I think it starts to mean more to you. And I think if you can catch the bug a little younger and connect those stories, you become a better storyteller, you become a better bearer of the torch, and you become a better citizen in a sense. I think the more you know your history, you are encouraged to be a more active citizen. And not that people aren't active citizens today, but I think there could be a better basis for people's knowledge of where
Yeah.
their active citizenship comes from. How about if I say it that way?
No, definitely. I remember I studied medieval history in university, and I used to have a poster of Mikhail Gorbachev up on my wall, and there was a quote of his, and it was actually kind of a joke to remind me to get to class on time. But it was history forgets those who come late. And often I know what you were saying. When we come late to actually even, his was that if you're coming late as far as ideas, but I feel that, if you come late to understanding your history, a lot of times, you don't get that really perspective. You might not realize, oh, people have gone through these things before. This is similar to this, or, oh, look what happened to that society, culture, or that had a similar things they were going through. Without that knowledge, you don't have that appreciation. You don't, even without the knowledge of your own family, you lose that what they struggled to make. I think Canada is a great country to make Canada great. To make Canada what it is. I have a I joke that of my strong Scottish ancestry. I'm half Scottish, half Irish. When I actually found out from my DNA test, I'm a little more other things. But I really have that. And there was a comedy group that used to be out of Montreal called Bowser and Blue, and they had the song "The Scots That Made This Country." It was quite humorous, but there's so much truth in that, and understanding these forefathers, and sort of even what they were thinking of when they founded Canada, what they were thinking of that took them to Canada in the first place. And then when you can take and personalize and put your own family in that context, really makes it come alive and makes it important and makes it relatable. And that's one thing I really enjoy listening to you. I'm glad you instill that in students. And
And my podcast does focus on the immigration points in my family history. So I don't just kind of go at everyone in my family history and tell weird stories, but I do focus on immigration points. And you know, I'm glad you mentioned kind of why they come here, right? And well, the name of your podcast, How We Got Here, because the push and pull factors, you know, of immigration stories are really powerful, right? Particularly to Canadians. Canada is made up of so many different people that came here for so many different purposes in different waves of emigrations. And the context to that and the personal stories of those push and pull factors within those contexts are really powerful stories to Canadians like myself. So what I'm doing in my podcast is I take a particular lens of personal healing and anti-racist work, right? And listen, you can contextualize history and extract from it gazillions of things. You can be as creative as you want, but that's my particular lens that I'm taking from it. And so those push and pull factors that I'm looking at when I'm telling my family stories are really important to seeing those pillars that hold up the power of colonialism and what it meant to my ancestors in different historical time periods, and indeed how it's still, I guess, privileging me, and how it's still a kind of lending to how I'm walking through the world and how I'm seeing the world. And, you know, so many light bulb moments, like I can't even tell you, since starting the podcast and just the act of putting together those narrative stories and contextualizing the names and the dates and the, you know, the travel periods, it's been such an eye opener.
Yeah, so many people want to walk through life with rose colored glasses on, so to speak. And when you contextualize it and look through the glasses of history, which generally aren't rose colored, blood stained, you know, mud and mire over the years as the ground was tilled, salt water and on the lenses fogging them up as your ancestors came across from the sea. And, you know, yeah, there's so much that, you know, to give that clear vision. I know we talked a little bit previous to this, and we were going to share, since I do try to focus on Atlantic Canadians, sort of the, as many Canadians there have ancestry that they can dig back, to the past before the 19th century, even the early 20th century, a lot came through Atlantic Canada at one point or another, or there's roots in somewhere on the line in the Atlantic Canada. So do you mind just, I understand you had been recently finding out some surprises that you didn't realize were Atlantic Canadians. So do you mind sharing those?
Yeah, sure. So one of the areas of my family tree that I've been kind of reluctant to do research on is my mother's side, which is French. So I've been kind of reluctant to dig in there because I don't read or speak French. So it's a little intimidating, right? To get those documents and you think, okay, I've got to read this and interpret it. And, you know, even interpreting in English is difficult. If you look at a historical document, even when you know the same language, you know that those words mean different things. There's words that you don't even use anymore. The handwriting often is the, you know, cursive handwriting and stylistic cursive handwriting and historical terminology that you're not familiar with. It's difficult just reading English. So when I come across French documents, I'm just like, oh, forget it. I'm like too out of my element. I can't even do it. But there's been so much American research on the Fidoua. So my last episode was on the Fidoua, or, you know, if you, I always pronounce it Fideroy because I'm super English. but a lot of that research was done in English. So luckily I could put together a story and understand the history and not have to be too far out of my element. And I'm finding it's the same with the Acadians. So I'm finding there's a lot of people in English who have left, or interpreted historical documents, or you can find historical documents in English, probably because of who was handling the situation or involved in the situation, which is British. But yeah, so I'm finding that branch is a little easier to investigate. So that's been nice. But yes, so we talked about a week ago and you asked me to be on the show. And I said, I think I have some Acadian ancestors. I don't know, but I could check. And, you know, I knew that there were some connections, like I mentioned to you before, there were some Rodericks who ended up in Louisiana, and you asked me if they were Acadian. And I said, you know, I don't think so. I'm not sure how Rennie Roderick got to Louisiana, but I don't think it was the usual pathway, the Acadian expulsion. But anyway, so after a little bit of digging, it's like I find one, I find two, I find three, I find four, I find five, and that's just one little branch. So my maternal great-grandmother, Taze Talbot, her whole background is Acadian. And so I'm looking at one little tiny branch in the back of her, and I'm choosing that particular branch because it is a branch that has linked me with a person in my hometown who has been identified to me through a DNA website that I have my DNA on as a distant relative. And so I tried to contact her a couple of times. I'm still waiting for a response, but I thought, wouldn't this be a great story if I could connect with this woman in my hometown, Windsor, Ontario, and the expulsion starts, they start rounding them up in Windsor, Nova Scotia, right? And, you know, this person is from the same family. So we're distant because it goes back to the 1700s. So we're linked through a line called Cyr, C-Y-R. And I hope I'm pronouncing that okay. But yeah, so it's Jean Christopher Cyr is the earliest ancestor that we're connected by. And that person was actually in Nova Scotia. He's our contact point, I think 1624.
Wow.
So you're talking like super early, and we're connected through this person's family. And so, yeah, we're distant relatives, but I mean, you know, 200 plus years later, we wind up in the same town together, like in another province, you know, and I thought that would make an interesting story. So I'm trying to trace, you know, the exact paternal line through Cyr, how I got to Windsor, and tell the story of how I got to Windsor, which I tell partially in some previous episodes, but it'd be interesting to go that early back and link it down through and then hear her story, right? So I go to her tree and she actually doesn't have a lot on the Cyr line. She has kind of a brick wall there. So I told you I went to the Nova Scotia archives and you can download these family name trees. So I downloaded the family name tree for Cyr. And sure enough, I probably could add like 20 people to my tree just from that tree that I downloaded. And so hopefully it can help her out too. I've got to start going through the brothers and sisters and kind of see where we kind of diverge and where things go. But I'm hoping to connect up with her and weed that all out and tell that story. So it's, hopefully that'll be an interesting story in the future. But yeah, so it's the Cyr line that I'm connected to. And in their family as well is the bourgeoise and the Richards. And there's one more that I'm forgetting. The O'Quans, the O'Coins. And it's funny, in talking to you too before the show, you're saying these are still very common names like around your area. So yeah, it's kind of interesting. I'm going to have to add Nova Scotia into my car trip, I think. So I don't know if you remember, but I told you inspired me to make some New Year's resolutions, which was to plan my genealogy history road trip. And so I was planning on just going through Quebec, but I definitely have to go to Nova Scotia now.
Oh yeah. And New Brunswick. And if you make it this way to Île-Saint-Jean or Prince Edward Island, as we call it here, yeah, there's still a lot of vibrant Acadian communities in Atlantic Canada, and a lot of the names you mentioned are names that are still prominent Acadian names, definitely. So, yeah. So in the 16, were they in Cape Breton in the Louisbourg area? Were they down in Port Royal, or what? for the
Yeah, so they're coming, they're the first point of landing is, well, I guess now it's called Amherst, but then it was called Beaubassin,
Okay.
which is the like Acadia, right? So, and I guess Beaubassin was an earlier name for Amherst, if I'm reading my sources right.
Okay.
And so, yeah, so Amherst, Cumberland County. So, like, I'm seeing some entries on people's trees where, you know how sometimes people don't choose the historically specific name? You know that? So, yeah, so some people are putting Amherst on and some people are putting Beaubassin on. And it's so, I guess Beaubassin is the historically specific place where they landed, Acadie. And there was one or two generations that stayed there, and then safe haven was sought on the island of Miquelon, and they
Okay.
were there for a while. And you know, from what I'm gathering, you know, and I'm really early in the story, so I'm sorry if it's this kind of disjointed story right now, but maybe it'll appeal to people to come and listen to the story when it finally gets put together. But anyway, so Miquelon was a safe haven because it's French territory. And then when things settle back down, they come back. But what I'm seeing in the story is after the expulsion, there's probably not a single generation that doesn't do some migrating. It's really interesting. It's just like they just move and move and move and move and move, even if it's a town to town or province to province, or you know, even my grandfather and my mother. My grandfather did an international migration. He wound up living in Florida and getting remarried after, you know, him and my grandmother split up. But even my mother, there was provincial migration. She came here with my father in the 50s to look for industrial work in Windsor. Windsor's an industrial town. And just migration. And every generation is like that from the time of when they came back from the expulsion. And I find that very telling. Very telling of what the effect of the expulsion had on families and their sense of being rooted in a place, you know. And everything that I'm gathering from Acadians, from my vast knowledge so far, which is about like 2 hours of reading, is that, you know, they had an agricultural system and subsistence farming, you know, set up that was pretty much the envy of everyone around them. Like they knew the land and they knew how to work it. And it was particularly hard land to work, right? So they were living on a bit of a wetland. Is that right? My.
Yeah, there's the Tantramar Marsh all up through the
Yeah.
Amherst and that or part of New Brunswick that connects there. Yeah, would be st still there is a lot of marshland and not marshland, a lot of bedrock still
Yeah.
on and
Yeah, not your
for
traditional farming, you know,
no.
area, but they made the best out of that you could possibly, you know, do, and they knew the land and they had lived there for generations. And then right as soon as that, you know, they come back from Miquelon, it's just moving, 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 moving every single generation. And I find that really interesting. It's something I have to think about in wrapping up the story.
And that must be something even as a genealogist that is challenging. You mentioned like diving into Nova Scotia records, which you probably weren't familiar with, like having them to yeah, just to reposition yourself and your thoughts and knowing what is available is so many things, even from province to province in Canada, the way records are organized, what's available, you know, and where a lot of those records that might not be on government archive sites would be able to be gotten. I know that's been a challenge for myself. I've been lucky that a lot of my ancestors stayed in Atlantic Canada for a large period, particularly Nova Scotia, in two or three specific regions. But even then, when you're digging church records, there's a whole difference. And the Protestant side of the Scottish Protestant side of my family, and the Catholic Irish side of my family, where the records are, what kind of things I can expect, where they were actually collected, and even with some of the, you know, the ancestry you know, My Heritage and those other sites, which ones have which records. And, well, I'm looking up this person. Well, where do I need to look for their records? It can be very challenging. Yeah, so if that constant migration, I mean, on the positive side is, you know, constantly re-educating and educating yourself and keeping on top and probably finding new perspectives also to look at things when you might find a source for a record type besides the traditional birth, marriage, death sort of records. But when you start looking into land use records and wills and probates and just other things that are out there that you might find that you might not have ever found before. Like one thing I've been lucky with is with Scottish Presbyterians, their presbyteries and their church sessions, they often have good records, and that is, you might not find an actual former record. You might find a family, a person from the family mentioned in, if you take the time to read through the minutes of meetings. And whereas in my Catholic family, I don't find as much of that. The things I find is from finding local parish records or diocese records. And even that's confusing because some of the dioceses have the full set of records, and then there's some that you can still find at the local parish levels. And depending on what might have happened in churches at different points where you might find them. So yeah, that must be exciting, but challenging. So this family, they were from there. You said they went to St. Bernard-Miquelon, and then they came back, and that they, where did you say they resettled again originally? And then?
Yeah. So from Miquelon came back to Beaubassin, and then from Beaubassin to Quebec City, and then from Quebec City to various different points. And yeah, it's really, like you said, it's challenging tracking people, but you know, fortunately in this particular story, I'm tracing one particular line that leads like from me to, you know, the original seer entry point. So
yeah, that does make it a lot easier. Sometimes I do find it, you know, it's great if you can concentrate and focus on that. I find myself, just because it's just a love of history that I've always had, and a love for finding out about my family. I find sometimes I get sidetracked on these roles, and sometimes it's a great resource because I am able to find a grand or great uncle, so to speak, of one generation or another, or aunt, or cousins, that when I find them, I'm able to, you know, maybe connect to that next level down. Is some, I can find clear records to them, and I can connect them now. Mm-hmm. I've been fortunate in a few cases that I've been able to do that. And then there's this missing generation that I can't quite, but at least I've gotten above that. So I now can start searching for that grandparent, or great grandparent of one level or another, and then finding that connection to where they go. So do you know much about where they came from originally, what parts of France? I know you had in the last episode was a great story about the I forget how many great grandmother that came from Paris, and how she wound up here. So you found out what, have you been able to dig that deep to find out what they in France, where they came from, what areas, what their life was? You mentioned they were farmers here, that they come from these families that were urban, that came to a wound up coming to a rural setting and farming for the first time, or?
Yeah, it's well, actually, I don't know about their occupations or anything. I haven't gotten that far deep, but it is Blemont, France, which is, like an eastern border town, like I was telling you. And this family is particularly of Danish descent.
Okay.
Right, yeah. So it's kind of interesting. This will be the second story where it's kind of like you know, and there's other French people in my from France in my background too, and their names are all like so-and-so of the Swiss, okay. blah, blah, blah of the Swiss. And there's a whole family like that, and they call themselves so-and-so of the Swiss. And so, you know, France is interesting too, because they have a history of, you know, occupations and, you know, and, you know, obviously someone who's Danish and is in France, your mind can probably make connections, but I honestly don't know. Like I'm at the beginning of the story. So I was actually going to ask you for your advice on Acadian expulsion sources.
I don't have any relatives that, well, on my descendant line, so I haven't done a lot, but there are some great sources out there. There's actually there's a Facebook group, and there's actually a society of Acadian genealogists that do a lot of research, and a lot of that, like you said, is spurred on by Americans who are Cajuns who are tracing their family back here. I don't know if it's the political situation, they're trying to connect to Canada so they can find a way out at one point that had gotten them over the years, or if it's that pure interest. But I think a lot of it, you know, the same sort of thing, you know, you can, that we experience in Canada, you can get to a certain point where you find certain branches, but like, where did this other part of my family come from? And yeah, how did they get here? Why did they come here? And they're starting to do that. But they know they're French, but they're wanting to dig in more. Like that helps their resource. And a lot of these people there are groups that you can find. I haven't had a lot myself. I'm actually hoping to get an episode in later in the year. I'm thinking early spring, late spring, early summer, to specifically talk. I have a couple people in mind, and I'll definitely hook you up with them.
Okay.
It's finding them. And a lot of times it's, if the relative is stuck around, it's trying to figure out what they might've anglicized their name to, because that's common. As I mentioned, a lot of the names are still here. But also understanding the French, the reasons they have certain surnames and stuff isn't always the same as the English. Like you mentioned, the Swiss or...
Well, even the name Bourgeois, it's like, you know, what's behind that?
Yeah, and what we have an association with what bourgeois means now. Well, is that what it meant from, or is that just we've developed something that word because there was a family bourgeois that were that bourgeois class, but that's not what the name originally meant. It is, and with the expulsion, sometimes it's hard from talking to other people because their records, some of that transition period, people didn't want to be known as Acadian. They didn't want to be, they tried to sort of blend in. But there's a lot of stuff. And like I said, there's a lot of, the names are still here. The place names are, there's obvious that have that Acadian influence. And there's still people that live on where I'm in Prince Edward Island that are Acadian French, don't speak English. Especially in a lot of the older generation, and there's still that French influence in certain parts that is definitely visible. And it's interesting, there was a lot of mixing, especially with Irish families. I think the same thing as you'd find in Montreal and stuff, and a lot of that was based on religion. And also you're in small places, so there would be a lot of intermarrying that happens. So a lot of times you can find, if you find one relative, one group of families, you can actually wind up connecting yourself to a lot because, and the whole communities, it's just because of the lack of other people with the same culture as you, that you that you would marry or that would be acceptable to your family, because you know you wouldn't want to be the one that married an Englishman or so yeah.
And there's just different levels of acceptability in the past of, you know, what we would call today intermarrying, like probably marrying a distant cousin or a second cousin would be nothing.
Yeah, especially when that's, you know, I'm thinking of Prince Edward Island. You're on an island. There's, you know, there's not a lot of different families, and it wasn't easy to get here. It was a place when you would come, and you know, you settled. People were, you know, families that had been settled by one or two families. Well, you go after a few generations. That's the other people that are around. They're those cousins. Mm-hmm. And
especially in certain farming communities that I'm familiar with in my family's background, their families were so huge.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
even today, it's not uncommon. I mean, in Acadian families, when you look at wedding and announcements, it's the Arsenal wedding. They're not the close cousins that make you cringe, but there was probably that common ancestor, whether it was actually in North America or they were two brothers that came over from France and their families, you know.
And between the two of them, they had 25 kids, you know, yeah.
Yeah, and then that, as you multiply the generations down, and, you know, it's still a common thing. But that's one thing exciting. Genealogy. I actually did a YouTube video that I did this week where I proved that I was related to a king of England. But then when I explained how he's my 25th great grandfather, and I explained, well, how many 25th great grandparents he had, which is 100 and some odd million. And knowing my family was from the United Kingdom, well, it's one of my ancestors was my 24th great grandfather and my 24th great granduncle. Edward Longshanks. Don't tell my Scottish family about that. You watch Braveheart. You don't. You know he's an evil Englishman that you know did a lot of harm to Scottish people. But when you look at the number of people that are your great grandparents, then it was the population of England, Scotland, and Wales. I forget at that time it was estimated to be about 6 million people. But I have 135 million great grandparents that were that 25th great grandparents. Well, there's got to be some of them were multiple generations, grandparents or granduncles and stuff that, you know, it doesn't take long to start piling up.
Right. And when you think of the sheer, you know, number that your tree can grow to, and you think of the population size as you go that far back, you know, and you put those two things together, it's not surprising at all, honestly.
And I mean, and I'm sure that people, you know, 200 years from now will still have those families that, you know, oh, you're related multiple ways to the same person. So that is of our generation and our time. It's the way history and goes, but it's a really interesting path to take, and I like it too, because it makes that the filling in that those spots on my fan chart of my ancestors a lot easier when I can double root them and include people in multiple spots.
Less paperwork for me.
Well, I don't actually have to look for 135 million 25th great grandparents. I can find one, and there are actually several of them, So with your podcast, so what do you have planned coming up for in the near future, and for if you don't mind sharing?
No, I don't mind sharing.
You know what, I really enjoy the stories of your family. I enjoy the way you tell them too.
Thank you.
You know, it's just you make the characters, you know, come to life and have historical meaning for me, which is what genealogy is supposed to do. Mm-hmm. So, yes, what kind of things you have planned coming up? Are you going to be following this Acadian story now at some point in the future? I'm assuming, as you dig deeper.
Yeah. What? I'm going to try to get to a couple more immigration points on my mother's side, and a lot of that depends on wading through those French documents. I just can't believe, though, how generous people are online with passing on translations that they do and passing on interpretations. So hopefully I can get a few more stories out of my mother's side of the Maple family treehouse. And that's the big plan, is to get a few more Roderick stories out. But I'm also thinking about ending the season off with some stories about, if I can make them into personal narratives, on big history. And I'm in the midst of getting a genome workup done too. So deep history, like how deep history works. So I gave a little bit of a story of my links to a couple Viking archaeological sites that were done in England. And the way they kind of fill in the gaps in those ancient sites is, I guess, kind of doesn't sit with everybody okay, but you know, they make for fun stories. And you know, the fact that you are, in some way, even if it is a small way, even if they do explode it a little bit, that you are linked to these people in these archaeological sites is just really fascinating. So I'm going to dig a little bit deeper into that. So I guess the majority of my deep DNA looks at the steppe pastoral history. So pastoral, you know, pastoral migrations from the east, I guess you could say, and into Scotland. And so I know you know my last name is Sharman, but I guess that's a bit of a variation on Shearman, which means shearing the sheep. So I think I'm going to end the podcast kind of talking about what I've learned over the season before I take a break a little bit before next winter or next fall. And give a bit of my take on big history and deep history using genome, and talking a little bit about the steppe pastoral history and connecting that to my name, which is
Oh.
Shearer of the Sheep.
Well, that's a great way to, you know, to sort of wrap things up in the there, and it brings you this you know, your Scottish roots, which, you know, again, was a Celtic Canadian. It's really funny. Anything you ever have, I always get disappointed whenever I have to fill out any forms to ask me my ethnicity. I never see Celtic on there. I see British, but I never see Celtic, so I can't always claim my, there's another, I usually try to put it in there. But no, what a great way. So you're still teaching history?
I'm not teaching history. I've actually switched up jobs. I'm a little more of a generalist educator now, and
Okay.
probably which is why I started the podcast, because I miss teaching history a little bit, and it's actually helping me continue on my education a little bit. Like, you know, I don't know anything. I mean, you know the Acadian story, generally speaking. But I don't know the details of it, and I've just started reading a really good book on it, and I'm getting right into it. And it's, you know, the pressure to kind of, you know, get through the book and put together the story and tie it to yourself is really an education piece that's just priceless. Like, I would recommend anyone who hasn't kind of done something like that before, even if you've just done genealogy, you know, I really, really encourage everyone to connect it to a larger narrative in history and make that larger narrative personal to you. It makes learning history so much different in ways that I can't even put into words. Like, it's so different, right?
Okay. Well, speaking of, about books, I'm going to ask you that. You don't have to answer me now, but one thing I do like to do with my guests is I do have a recommended books section on my page, my website page, that I put if there's books that on a particular topic that we've been talking about that I can put, so if people are interested in digging in more. So yeah, if you want to, you know, send along me those a few of those, and I'll make sure they get on the website. My other question I was going to
Okay.
ask you about your teaching. So do any of your students have they listen to your podcast, or
No, the
they,
context I'm working in now, you really have to keep a kind of a professional distance.
okay.
So no, but there are a few colleagues that that are interested and have listened. Yeah.
Okay. Now
In fact, I think One of my newest subscribers is, you know, a colleague that's given me a lot of really good feedback. She's also a history teacher. So, you know, hopefully, who knows? Like, you know, maybe, I'm open to it. But yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
my initial question is, if you were still teaching history, was, oh, has doing this to your, with your podcast for your students, if any of them heard it, that it opened them up to wanting to explore it. But it's great that even you have colleagues that, you know, are there and able to fill in the story for you. You're definitely right. Understanding the bigger history. I always encourage people mm-hmm. because, you know, sometimes it's hard to find specifics about your ancestors other than their names, maybe what they did, where they lived, but there's not a written narrative about them. And to understand them, if reading history and putting them in that context of that situation that you're reading really makes a difference. Reading books, and actually I read some weird things occasionally, just in the sense that it's not your everyday reading, but going through I have a lot of family in Cape Breton that were involved in the mining industry, and there was a lot of at the turn of the early turn of the 20th century, there was a lot of unrest, and there was a lot of political action that was taken. And there's a lot of things that are written about it. And then getting to understand, my relatives were miners, so they would have been involved in it. And actually I found out through my great grandmother recently, because she, who died in 1979, I found out from her, because I was lucky enough to find a recording of somebody had interviewed her about 2 years before she died. But her brother, one of her brothers, though he actually came to Canada before her parents and her did, he was one of the leaders in the mining movement. And it really, when I was able to find out that and connect, well, this is a person, and she was talking about some of these people I had read about and how they had come to her parents' home when she's still living with her parents. It makes that personal, and it's great, and I can really relate to it a lot more, and it makes me appreciate it as Canadian history, because it makes it personal to me and makes it me appreciate it, because, you know, that's my family, that's my people, so to speak.
Sure. You know? Yeah, and it's really emotional work, and I think that's one thing I wasn't prepared for getting into it, was the emotional work that goes into it. It's kind of exhausting emotionally. But, you know, I come from a really working class background too, one that where my family did discount their history as being valuable, or their stories being valuable, like participating in labor movements and things like that. And, you know, I think I've really transformed them. Like, if anything else, like, one of the reasons why I started the podcast was honestly to share the stories with my family. And I thought, well, if it goes any further, great, I'll try to spin it for a larger audience. But I'm really trying to share stories with my family. And, you know, at first they're kind of like, oh, you're going to air all our dirty laundry. We have so many kooky people in our family. I'm like, yeah, but that's what makes the stories good.
Yeah.
But it is emotional work, right? I mean, you know, like I've said in a few of my stories, we're not proud of all our stories, but I think if you get out in front of it and you be honest with it, no one can take that away from you, right? So, if you can do the emotional work, I would really encourage you to do it. But I also appreciate, you know, and just going back to some of my students, that you can't always do it, right? And so if you're a kid and people aren't willing to tell the stories, or you don't know the stories, or you don't have the resources, or you just don't have a connection to your, like, blood relatives, right? In some cases, you have those students, you know, they're left with this, well, you know, what stories do I tell, right? And while my academic background is in researching institutional stories, right? And I know you do community stories too. And that's something that can be really powerful, is the stories that you tell of involvement in institutions and what institutions have done for you and your relationships to institutions, especially institutions of power, right? Like school. So in one of my students' cases, he had no resources to do any family history, but his dad had a business and he was a second generation businessman, and he did a business history for the website. And he loved it, his family loved it, he loved doing it. And I was like, hey, whatever works, you know? And, you know, does that prep him to be the third generation in a more deeply integrated, authentic way? Yeah, I think it does, you know? And so that's a really creative way of you know, doing a history that's kind of outside the box, even if you can't do, you know, your bloodline. Yeah. Or something like that. You know, you can investigate your connection to your community, your connection to the people who love you, who have made a family around you. You can make a connection to, you know, the institutions that have taught you what they've taught you, for better or for worse, right? So, yeah.
I just wanted to thank Cale for coming on to the show, and I just to close up the show, I just want to talk about a little bit of a genealogical collaboration. Now, one of the great ways I collaborate is using WikiTree. I've talked a little bit about before. It's just a great site to actually collaborate. I do like the people involved. There's a lot of great people out there that use it, and there's a lot of people there that will help you. Other sources of collaboration is I find the genealogical Facebook groups for Atlantic Canada, they're great for if you're looking for help. They're people are willing to give you a hand, but the one thing about collaboration, you know, it just make sure it's not always a take. Make sure you're giving back a little. It's always good to give and help. You never know what information you've picked up along the way that might help somebody else. Never feel you're too new or too young to contribute. You never know what things you might have discovered that some of us old timers haven't. Yeah, so, and then the great way is a thing about collaboration is if you can actually find a genealogical buddy. And by this, I mean you can have a mentor or just even somebody else that's doing research on their own family tree, or somebody that's working on your family tree. Somebody to keep you accountable, because it gets hard and it actually gets discouraging sometimes when you're working away at your family tree. And it's great to have somebody you can bounce things off to keep you accountable and to you know, push you when you need to be pushed, and to give you ideas and help remind you of why you're doing this. And the greatest collaborator you can have is your family. Make sure you're reaching out. I know I gotta do that again soon to a few of my older family members, and there's a couple that I know they have some information I need, and I need to do that. So it's a reminder myself and a reminder to you, don't forget those people. And don't just use them for their, as a genealogical source. Take time to get to know them, get them to learn their stories, and make them meaningful to you. And if you don't have somebody like that in your family that you can talk to, even if you, as we talked about with Cale, if there's somebody in the community or a community historian for where you're looking at, take the time to talk to them. Get to know the stories of the places your family are from. And also, I encourage you finding a long-distance buddy. And by that I mean, if you're searching for ancestors in a community or in a certain area, if you have a bulk of your ancestors from there, make sure you're reaching out to the genealogical societies there. Check out their Facebook groups. Check out other genealogists from around that area. Find somebody who might be able to help you out if you're falling short and you're not able to find what you need. And also just somebody who can share the resources and the secrets of that region. Every region has their places where they store their documents or even ways of understanding them that are could be a little different in their own secrets and tips, as well as individuals. So take the time, reach out and find somebody in that place that your ancestors are from. You never know who you might meet. And getting back to WikiTree, one of the great things I found for it is that I've actually been able to make some contact with some relatives that I sort of knew existed, maybe not by name, but actually have been able to reach out to them. And also actually through my DNA tests, I've been able to track down a few relatives that I didn't know before, but I can place them in my family tree very easily. And it's been great to actually talk to them, meet them, and share our own sides of the family and the knowledge that we have. So until next time, you know, go find somebody to be your genealogy buddy. Go seek out that relative. Go seek out somebody from where your ancestors came from originally, and you know, make a new friend and help each other and help your fellow genealogists around the community on Facebook and elsewhere to share what you know. And if you see somebody asking a question, make sure you answer. If you know the answer, or even if you can start to guide them on where they might find it. Just be a good genealogist, a good collaborator. And so until next time, stay safe and keep looking for those relatives.
Thank you for listening to this episode of How We Got Here. Make sure you check out the show notes for more information about today's topic and guests. How We Got Here is hosted and produced by Brian Nash. Title music from Tribute to O'Carolan by Luna Bajowski.